Hello friends, it's 2021 and we're back with a new episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
It you. Isn't it nice to be back?
Together again.
Reunited. Friends reunited, if you will.
I've missed you, bud.
Yeah, me too. And obviously, you know, I missed recording the pod, but I think fundamentally, I just miss hanging out.
Exactly. I mean, I miss hanging out anyway, but at least recording the pod means that every single week, without fail, we get like an hour of chill time.
So true. But we don't get our little pints and we don't get our crisps, and then I don't ask you to turn the crisp packet into a triangle.
There is which is one of my special talents. I love folding the crisp packet. Although I can't do a triangle, I do a little knot.
Yes, you do. I lose track of who's who in my life. Who's a triangle, who's a knot.
It's our personality types.
So true. Introvert, extrovert discourse is over. Triangle or not is the new personality type. What have you been reading, my good friend?
So I have had a great time reading. I handed in the first draft of my novel to my agent at the beginning of January. So then I just like a whole 3 weeks, maybe a whole month of just pounding through books. So I've read like 12, but I'm not going to go through all of them because this isn't my diary. I'm just going to pick out like one of my faves and then maybe I'll discuss some others in a future episode. So my kind of book of the month would probably be Little Scratch by Rebecca Watson.
Oh, yes, I have this. I was kindly in receipt of a copy from our mutual friend, Jordan Taylor-Jones, and I'm very excited to read it. Tell me about it.
So, Little Scratch is an experimental novel. It's a stream of consciousness. So, along the lines of Grief is the Thing with Feathers or Ulysses, or Peach by Emma Glass. It has that kind of internal monologue kind of vibe to it. And it's basically one woman's thoughts through an entire 12 hour, like her waking thoughts in over a single day. And I just loved it. It's really formally experimental. Even on the page, it's very creative in the way that it's presented. Like thoughts interrupt each other. She has intrusive thoughts. The only thing that exists outside of her own head is dialogue and text messages, which I guess, you know, like they're still things that she is like processing with her brain. So every now and again, she'll be having a conversation and she'll have like intrusive thoughts interrupting and she's reacting to each thing that the other person says. And like, yeah, it's just really clever and smart. And it's the kind of thing that I whipped through in like over the course of an evening. I loved it. I cannot recommend it enough, especially if you quite like really formally creative fiction.
I am so hyped to read it.
I think you'll like it.
Yeah, I think I will like it.
The other thing,
you know, if it's kind of low maintenance to read in terms of like it not being a million pages long.
The other thing as well, though, is that it just really made me miss normal life.
Yeah.
You know, like she wakes up with a hangover. She goes to work. She spends her day in the office. She goes to a literary event. She goes to the pub. Like, it's a very unremarkable day, but it's everything that she is processing that creates the thrust of the book. And it just made me miss pubs. Everything makes me miss pubs. Like, staring at the TV, everything makes me miss pubs. But yeah, this book in particular, this like slice of normal life.
I'm hyped. I'm definitely going to read that soon. I read several books in January and found that I did not particularly enjoy any of the fiction I read. I had a bad month for fiction. And given that I don't read a ton of nonfiction, I'm glad that I did last month, because my favourite book I read in January was People Who Eat Darkness by Richard Lloyd Parry, which is a nonfiction book. Do you know this book, Alice Slater?
So I did not know this book, but you tweeted about it and I just bought it immediately. I didn't even press pause.
I'm an influencer. So it's about a thing that happened in my lifetime that I do not remember, as with many things, it seems. But it's basically an exploration, investigation of the life and death of Lucy Blackman, who was murdered in Japan. And it's just incredibly well written, incredibly thoroughly researched. Something I really liked about it was that it's incredibly insightful about many facets of Japanese culture, but it doesn't feel like it's kind of pathologizing or othering Japan and Japanese-ness. And, you know, there's a lot with this kind of crime. I think at the time there was quite a lot of tendency to try and make it like this is a quintessentially Japanese crime for some reason. And it really kind of tries to explain why that is not correct. It's, yeah, very got a lot of quite interesting stuff about her family and what happens to a family after they experience such a kind of traumatic thing. But yeah, that is definitely my book that I have got the most out of in recent times. And now I'm reading another nonfiction book, which also is kind of crimey flavored, which is Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran, which is about the way that the FBI came about and is largely about the Osage tribe in Oklahoma, who became very rich due to oil being found on their land. And then members of the tribe started getting murdered. And that is the backdrop to why the FBI was formed.
Oh my God. So I had absolutely no idea about that.
100% no idea. Didn't know. I basically never wondered why the FBI was formed, for one. Didn't know anything about the process of finding oil, didn't know anything about the impact that that had, for better or for worse, on Native American tribes, didn't know anything. So it has been so interesting. I am loving it. So yeah, nonfiction is really saving my ass in 2021.
Saying like, but yeah, you've reminded me that I've read mostly fiction because I've been catching up with like stuff that I wanted to read, all my January releases, because I decided because of the pod I'm going to try and read books in order that they're released rather than just skipping ahead to the proofs that I'm most excited about,
which is great for you but annoying for me when I have read stuff that I want to talk to you about and I then cannot. I totally accept your approach. It's almost like you should be doing my thing and I should be doing your thing, because you have a much better memory for things you've read than me. So really, I should be the one that is waiting until the month that something is released to read it. And maybe indeed that, I will do that.
Maybe you should. I really recommend it because it is also forcing me to read stuff that proofs that otherwise may have taken a back seat, you know, because like I have some stuff on my little proof shelf right now that I'm so excited about. And I have skipped ahead to read Yes, Yes, More, More by Anna Wood because she's a good pal of mine. And I will skip ahead to read The Last House on Needless Street by Kat Ward because she's a good pal of mine. But otherwise, yeah, just being forced to read stuff that, although, I'm interested in it because I have, you know, I have a proof for a reason. I don't say yes to stuff that I'm not interested in. But, you know, the shininess of new things can mean that, you know, you can't resist temptation, you skip ahead and then things fall behind. So yeah, it has forced me to read more kind of broadly. But as a special treat, I watched the Night Stalker Netflix documentary last weekend, which I highly recommend if you have a strong stomach and a strong constitution for true crime. And I was so interested in it, I then picked up a book called The Life and Crimes of Richard Ramirez by Philip Carlyle. And it's been so long since I've just read well-written true crime.
Yes.
Like, it's not something that necessarily crosses my path very often.
Yeah, that's why I'm quite surprised to have been, like, reading two in such a short time that I feel is not just, like, you know, trashy, salacious true crime, but is actually, like, a really good book that is a nonfiction book about something crime adjacent.
It's difficult to tell with older work. It's difficult to tell what the quality of the book is going to be like because they all have trashy as fuck covers. So and like true. Actually, the one that you read, the name of which I've already forgotten, Those Who Eat Darkness.
People Who Eat Darkness.
People Who Eat Darkness. When was that released?
I think it was about 2006. Let's have a look.
because it has quite a classy cover.
Yeah, so you can tell, and it's released by Vintage, who I think are, you know, classic. Sorry, I completely lied. It was published at the end of 2010. So it was published 10 years after the Moida.
Interesting, because the book that I just read, the Night Stalker one, was re-released in 2010. It was originally written in the 90s. And for the 10-year anniversary, they re-released it with... The 10-year anniversary of the book being released, sorry. They re-released it with some new material. But the cover looks... just looks kind of trashy. And I guess it's that kind of reader in 2010 would not have been discerning, I guess. Like... Maybe that's unfair, mate. I don't know much about the true crime market in 2010, but I do know that it didn't exist in the same way that it does now. And so you would never know looking at the cover that it's really well written, and I think it's quite respectful. And it's definitely very out of date, though, because more has been revealed. He has been, obviously he's dead. Richard Ramirez is dead now, but there has been DNA evidence has linked him to more crimes, which are not included in this book, even though he was... a suspect in them, and the documentary goes into that. So yeah, in that regard it is a little bit out of date, but it's still an interesting read.
Fascinating. Maybe I'll try it, or maybe I'll do it on audiobook.
The only thing I will say, oh, the first third is the crimes, the middle third is his life, and then the last third is the trial. And the writer, it's a 600 page book, and the writer goes into every minute of the trial, so you are then reading the witness statements from the courtroom of the crimes that you have also just read about.
That's boring.
So it's quite, it is, it's interesting if you're interested in the workings of like a trial of a serial killer like that. But otherwise, yeah, it's a little bit repetitive. But in that third, it also goes into the Richard Ramirez groupies, which I was very interested in. So yes. I was kind of skimming the trial bits and then reading the bits about these women who were turning up every day because they were in love with him. So bizarre.
Maybe I'll do that on audio. Cheeky little Audible credit.
You'll certainly get your money's worth with that one.
Well, quite. And as we know, that's all I ever look for. Cool. So I feel like we've been very comprehensive in covering our recent readings. Shall we move on to the main topic of this episode?
Yeah, let's do the chat.
So the chat for this episode, because we are, both of us, writers, is writing. Alice?
I feel like I should make a dramatic noise or something.
Yes.
My immediate reaction was, don't do something weird that will make you seem like an absolute dickhead. So I just did silence, which you can't do on a podcast.
I wish you had your Halloween noise machine. Like make a little creaking door opening.
Like creaking door, owl, scream, chain rattle noise. Yeah. Yes. It's like the emojis of sound.
So, yeah. What do we want to talk about?
So, obviously, I know that the thing that you are working on has not been announced yet. So, and I don't want to go into detail of what I'm working on either. So, I was thinking that we would talk about our writing practices, how we get the words down on the page, how we approach editing, that kind of thing. That sound good?
Yes.
Okay, so my first question, I would like to know if you're a planner or do you just vibe?
I'm an intense planner. I hate to vibe. So before I write anything, I have to already know exactly what is going to happen. And I tend to write out like chapters 1 to whatever 30 or however many chapters I think there will be, and then I write one thing that will happen in each chapter that moves the plot along, and until I have that, I can't really start writing anything. So yeah, how about
you?
You have every
single beat planned out?
Yes.
And have do you ever deviate from that?
Don't think
like,
so.
Writing process, like if you hit, do you ever hit a beat that you're like, I want to rethink this now, or is the planning so meticulous that once you're writing it, that's set in stone?
I can't think of many times when that has happened in the writing process. Like maybe in the editing process, stuff will get removed or moved, but yeah, from my point of view, I tend to just write it the way that I envisaged it from that beginning. So yeah, I do not vibe. I'm very methodical and I tend to write chronologically because of that. So I can start at the beginning and end at the end because I kind of know what's going to happen in every chapter. How about you?
We are just the total opposite. I am all about the vibe. Yeah, all about the vibe. I think this is possibly because I write a lot of short stories. And with short fiction, like the spark that can ignite a short story can just be what a single conversation, a single character, a concept, a vibe, you know, an energy. And then you can really build around that one thing. Kind of like making pearls, you know, you have your little bit of grit, goes in the oyster, and you can create layers from that. With novel writing, that's much more difficult. I am now learning. So even though I've still written it in that fashion for my first draft, it was all vibe. I also don't write chronologically either because I go by whatever is most vivid in my head. So I will write whatever scenes start to kind of come into focus, I will get them down. I worry that if I don't do that, I'll lose that kind of authenticity. So yeah, I've written a lot of this book on the notes app on my phone in the middle of the night. I've written it on scraps of paper in random Word docs and created a really massive editing job for myself. But I'd rather follow my nature and feel like, I'd rather like follow my nature and feel like the scenes that I've written down have that authenticity to them. Whereas when I try and force it, I find I end up writing like, you know, you have these scenes that you have to have because something has to happen. Someone has to say something. Something has to be revealed. I do find that if I have action in the forefront of my mind, if I have plot first rather than scene, characterization, etc., this connective tissue will feel very bare bones. And I hate writing those scenes. I hate it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And yeah, often I find if I'm actually hating it, I think it shows in the writing anyway. I think the reader will hate reading it.
So true. I agree with that. I very much agree with that. For me, the whole like very meticulous plotting thing, I think because I didn't really write fiction until I wrote my first novel, No Big Deal. And so I didn't have like kind of that kind of creative confidence that told me that I could do it. So I thought if I put like everything in place to enable me in very practical terms to write a book, then the only thing that was standing between me and finishing the book was like writing the words. So yeah, I think it is partly that like I do not really have a creative writing background, and maybe you are more able to be like more creatively free because you have this very kind of long history of writing. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, that does definitely make sense. Like your background was journalism, right? You did a journalism.
Yes.
Masters, which is a completely different style of writing. That makes sense to me. Whereas for me, like writing was something that I've been doing as a hobby since I was a child, which obviously when you're doing something for pleasure, you don't do the bits that are boring, right? Like I've never been a plotter. So I wasn't plotting as a child. Well, I was plotting, but my schemes were not related to my writing. Interesting. Interesting that the different background would have such a big impact on, well, I suppose not really, it's inevitable really.
Well, yeah, I also just think like you are more like purely creative, like much like my beloved husband. You know, just really like aww, creative people who, yeah, I think you're more like instinctively creative, whereas like for me it's more like work that a challenge I set myself and then I complete it. Do you know what I mean?
100%. But I think that what's really important is that I don't think that I don't think it's a coincidence that I'm able to write the way that I write now that I'm working as a copywriter. Like my day job is I'm a copywriter for an agency. Before doing that, I did lots of freelance writing. I wasn't a stranger to writing to a deadline and a word count, but that discipline of having to turn up every day, having tasks in front of me that I had to write and had to finish, has really helped focus that kind of flighty creative brain. Because you can't really just be like you know, fucking all vibes, no plan all the time. You do have to add some structure somewhere. Even books that are formally creative and don't necessarily feel like they do have that working, the skill of the writer is to hide that work so it feels like it's all vibes, you know?
So true. So true. You're so wise. Yeah, I'm very kind of interested in how people feel about the editing process. And a theory that I developed, I did a kind of live event last week to launch a book called Love is for Losers by Vika Brueggemann, who is another Macmillan author who's also represented by my agent, therefore is cool. And she did the master's in writing for young people at Bath Spa. And when I was kind of interviewing her, I came up with a theory that maybe people who have come from a like creative writing education background, where they are used to like giving and receiving feedback, find editing more, maybe not easier, but like less traumatic or difficult than people who don't. How do you feel about being edited?
I love being edited, and I definitely, obviously, I mean, I have a creative writing background, so I can't speculate on what it would be like if I didn't have that background. But a big part of it is the crits. It's going through the workshop process and being having criticism from your classmates as well as your lecturer. And it really toughens your skin, and you learn a lot about how to evaluate your own work through that process as well. So yeah, I don't find it in any way hurtful or traumatic. It's just a practical examination of a thing I've made, and I live for it. I love it. Absolutely love it. Especially, there is nothing more satisfying when you have a bit of like a niggling doubt that something isn't working and someone reads your work and says, I'm not sure about this thing. It's so validating. Yeah, it's brilliant. And also the opposite is also great. When you have a little bit of doubt about something and someone affirms actually it's really good, also great. I guess the real pain is when you love something and someone else doesn't like it. But, you know, that's also fine. Sometimes you have to cut good shit for the sake of your reader. Like,
you know, in loads of books we've read, there must have been amazing stuff that we never got to read that, you know, we would maybe have enjoyed. But it has to be like that sometimes.
I mean, it's like the difference between, I mean, I don't know if this is a good or bad example, but Midsommar is already a really long film, right? And the director's cut is over 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Now, I fucking loved that. I was having a great time watching the director's cut, which is super long. But, you know, that's a long time to ask your viewer to sit in a cinema for something that they may not be 100% sold on. And I think that's the difference, isn't it? Like, if you love a book, you're going to wish that it could go on forever.
So true.
Actually, maybe your first reading, it's not the worst thing in the world if it just does what it needs to do.
You're so right. You're so wise. I've definitely, I was very anxious about, like, the editing process when I was working on No Big Deal, but then really like instantly learned to love it, just because I think at first I was like, oh, you know, I don't want to read about all the bad ways I did this book, like everything I did wrong. I don't want to be reminded of like the fact that it is bad. And then just over the course of that edit, which I actually did with two different editors because one went on maternity leave, I got so much out of it that I was just like, this is so amazing. Like, it's so incredible to have someone whose job it is to like know what is good and know, you know, technically how to accomplish what I'm trying to do. And then, have really found it very valuable ever since. And obviously, like, the labor of doing it can feel, for me at least, kind of tedious because it's not productive. And like, when you're writing a book, that feels like you're achieving something that did not exist before, whereas editing is just kind of, you know, swirling around in the same material. So from that point of view, I find the work is less like, in that moment, gratifying. I'd rather see my word count go up in a drafting thing, but ultimately is probably much more useful to like the actual outcome of the book. And for that reason, I love it.
Yeah, see, that's really interesting because the word count means very little to me. Like, although it is satisfying to reach something significant, and I'm not going to pretend that that's not the case, because editing is where I feel like my work comes alive. I feel like getting the words down is just kind of collecting the clay. You know, like, it's editing is when you start sculpting, and that's when I feel like I'm achieving shit. And a big part of that is because of how I write, you know, like, I used the kind of pearl analogy earlier, and that's really how I feel. It is like painting. The first draft is just the rough outline. It takes a lot more energy, redrafting, reworking, coming back to things, thinking, cutting, moving, adding texture, adding more layers of paint. That's when I feel like my writing starts to come into focus and starts to look the way that I want it to look. And that's the power of a really good editor. Like, a good editor is someone who will read the shit first draft and share the vision.
So true. And I feel like I'm definitely, the more books I write, the more that kind of relationship is changing. I just feel like a lot of my feelings about writing come from the fact that, like, I've only been kind of doing it for a relatively short amount of time and always with a specific project for publication to think about, rather than like doing it for fun or for, you know, kind of creative fulfillment. And I think in time that is kind of changing, and I am learning and growing every day.
It's definitely changing. Like, without saying anything I shouldn't, I definitely feel like the way that you've approached new projects over the last like 18 months, 2 years, however long it's been, has been different. There's been a different energy and a different kind of trajectory as well.
Yeah, I definitely feel a lot more confident now than I did around writing No Big Deal and that coming out.
Sorry, just for the sake of anyone who doesn't know, do you want to maybe describe your path to publication?
Yes. So I was a kind of blogger, journalist, gal about the internet for many years. And I was approached by an editor at Macmillan Children's, Rachel Petty, who basically said, I want to publish a book with a fat protagonist. I don't feel like I am getting those in submissions. And that's what I feel like that could be really kind of meaningful, useful representation. Have you ever written fiction? Have you ever thought about writing fiction? Would you be interested in trying to do this? And I hadn't written fiction, but I just thought, you know, this is someone who literally, if someone thinks I can do this, I'm sure I can find a way to do it. So I thought to myself, what if I only ever write one book, if I only ever tell one story, what is the story that I want to tell? And from that thought process, I produced the plot of No Big Deal. And I said to Rachel, this is the plot that I would want to write. Does that sound like a book? And she was like, yep, go and write it. And so I wrote it. And then there was still no guarantee that Macmillan would publish it, because you know, there's always, you know, a chance that I wrote something that was terrible. So I then had to get an agent who would then sell the book, hopefully to Macmillan, but maybe not. And then in the end they did sell it to Macmillan. So that was how my first book was published and why I started writing books. So I know I didn't start writing fiction because I thought it would be fun. I wrote it because someone said they wanted a specific book written and thought that I could maybe find it in myself to write that book. And that's how I kind of got started. And obviously I enjoyed it and then have gone on to write other books.
I just think it's a really interesting story because it wasn't a commission. You still had to go through the pain of finding an agent and selling it.
Yeah. And also like coming up with the plot, because, you know, something that we have learned, you know, the more time we've spent adjacent to the publishing industry, is that there are some projects that are the product of an idea that an editor has had, where they've come up with a plot, the characters, and then someone just writes the book and puts their name on it. This was not that. Like, everything in the book is a product of my brain. So I did have to like actually be creative when I was not used to it.
Do the work.
I had to do all the work. But I feel like you can tell when you read any of my books that they are written by me, because they sound like they're written by me.
Very much so. And that is what we call voice, my pal. Should I tell the story as to how I got an agent?
Please, because I feel like that is very interesting, because I bet loads of people that listen to us would like to be published. And I try and give advice, but because of my very, you know, unconventional route to publication, I can't really advise on a lot of stuff. So your experience is much more useful than mine.
It's still a little bit unusual, but I guess what I'm learning is that everything that I thought was unusual is actually really common, but people don't talk about it.
Yeah, because the narratives, there are a lot of different ways to make a mark.
Exactly. And like the narratives I think we're most kind of sold is the 1,000 rejections and then bestseller. And that is actually the rarest one. Mm. So my path to getting an agent, it's not necessarily my path to publication, because there's nothing is ever certain. But yeah, I've always written short stories, and I had, over the course of like a couple of years right after my MA, where I had a few published, and then I had a big fallow period where I was bookselling and not really writing. Then I left bookselling and I got back into short story writing and had another bunch published. Through those stories, an editor who was a mutual on Twitter found me and suggested that I consider an IP project, which is the term for a commission.
Which I was discussing earlier, basically.
And unfortunately, I will never be able to say what that project was, because I declined the opportunity. But I did seriously consider it, because it was very on brand for me. It was very fun and cool. I did lots of soul searching. But the problem was, I was already working on a novel, and I would have to put a pin in it to take on this other project. The editor recommended that I find an agent if I did want to do this project. So that's what I did. I submitted my novel and also information about the IP project without breaking my NDA to a variety of agents. And my number one choice got back to me straight away. She really liked my work. And then the rest of the story is a bit more kind of standard. But it does mean that I'm in this really lucky position, because you generally have to have a complete manuscript before you approach agents. And although I did have most of a manuscript, it was only 40K, 50K, and very, very rough. It wasn't really ready to be shared. So that's why I feel so lucky, because my agent, Zoe Ross, she still really liked it and agreed to, she signed me up and is working with me to get it finished. So yeah, I feel very lucky, but it just goes to show that like short stories and the stories that two of them were unpaid opportunities as well. But, you know, it's about picking those opportunities carefully and picking publications that, you know, your work will fit, it will vibe with, you know?
Yeah. And like, I know there's this very understandably like, you know, vibe of don't do things for exposure. But in some very, very select instances, it can make a difference, I would say.
Yeah, I think the main thing is really being educated about which publications you want to see your name in, which will be a good fit for you. If you're just Googling short story submission and sending your work off to every single opportunity that doesn't pay, you've got no control over like the quality of those publications, how valuable the exposure will be, all that kind of thing.
But yeah, I mean, I think like you had done the work over many years, and this was kind of the payoff in a way, that, you know, it wasn't like it came out of nowhere. You had been kind of putting your name on the map by doing loads of different stuff and writing lots and having it published and doing events and yeah
absolutely. But I think the main thing is writing. You just have to do the writing. It doesn't happen if you're not writing. And I know that sounds really obvious and basic, but the whole time that I was bookselling and not writing, I was in absolute agony, because every day that I wasn't putting words on a page, I was not working towards my goal. And this has been a lifelong goal. It's the only career, based goal I've ever had. It's the only thing I'm interested in. So yeah, you have to write. That's and my bottom line.
Achieving your goal is so on the horizon.
It is, but you can never, you're never done. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like what I have achieved at the minute is just that I've got someone who is like on side. I feel like you can't rest on your laurels.
You
the industry is so fickle. The current project, the reason why I'm being really coy about what it is because it might not sell and I might have to start again. And that's cool. Like, it will suck, but that's kind of what you have to do. You have to be prepared for that.
Yeah, it's always a possibility. And yeah, getting an agent is not the end of the road, but it's definitely like a necessary pit stop on the road.
Yeah, defo.
And it does make things just feel a little bit easier. It makes things feel easier because they will then become easier. But it's also having someone, you know, assuming your agent is a good editor, and I don't think all agents necessarily are, but to have someone, again, whose financial interests are in making your work good, you have someone who only gets paid if you get paid. So it's in their interests to try and make things as good as they can be so that you both get paid.
And I guess that's the other thing, isn't it? Is that not all authors want an agent who will do intense editing with them. Like, some agents are very hands-off, and that suits the author. Because obviously we're getting the book to a point where we can sell it to editors, but they will then go through a whole fresh editing process. So yeah, it's all about finding the right fit.
So true. Yeah, and that's been something that I have experienced. And I don't know if I've kind of really talked about it a lot very explicitly, let alone on the pod. But so I had an agent for 4 years with whom I sold Plus, which is my coffee table book, No Big Deal, Melt My Heart. And then she went on maternity leave just as No Big Deal was published. And then decided at the end of her maternity leave to not go back to work, which then left me with the decision of whether to stay with the same agency but have a different agent, or to leave the agency and just kind of start again, new agent, new agency. And I decided to leave and get a new agent because, although I really liked my agent herself and I have like really nothing but good things to say about her, I felt that the agency as a whole was not doing as good a job as they could have done with my work. And there are some examples that I will not give in case it would get me into trouble, but Alice, you are aware of them. And yes. Would you agree they are not good?
Yeah, it's not the best, was it? Wasn't the best time.
It was not the best time in some ways. And then I changed my agent and I'm now represented by Rachel Mann at Jo Unwin, whose submissions are currently open. And I think is just the coolest person in the world. I love her. I love my agency. She has been literally nothing but helpful, useful. And yeah, I am loving life now. So I think that although it can be kind of scary to have to put yourself out there again, it can be worth it. If you know in your gut that things are not working out for you with your agent, you don't feel like they're acting in your best interest, you don't feel that they're tying things up in a timely fashion. And that is a very subjective thing. But yeah, in some cases, you know, it's been dragged out too long. That's my story of agents.
And it's a valuable story because, again, that is also something that I think happens more often than I thought. Yeah, it's just interesting that, again, it's something that isn't necessarily something that the average reader would be interested in. But for writers, it is interesting. It's important. You want to know who's with who and who's moving on. And obviously, an author leaving an agency does not necessarily mean that the agency weren't doing a good job. It could also just be that as the author's career has developed, they're no longer a good fit. Like, there's so many different reasons.
Yeah, 100%.
It's an interesting tidbit. It's good to know, I think.
And everyone likes juicy little goss chat.
Everyone likes juicy goss, especially if they're listening to this podcast. I just want to ask those listening, if you would be interested in us doing a Q&A and answering some specific questions about writing or publishing, Let us know. I think that could be a fun episode. Maybe we'll do it in like 6 months or a year's time, like when there's been some distance between this one. Let us know.
Yeah, and obviously we can only kind of speak from our own experiences and the experiences that we have heard about on the grapevine. But I'm sure we could add a little something to someone's life in some way. Well, I've enjoyed this chat. I have enjoyed getting back on the horse and talking to my good friend and business partner, Alice Slater.
Me too.
You know where to find us on the internet. You know where we are. We're at What Page Pod everywhere. And we're not that hard to find as individuals on the internet. So if you want to track us down, offer us a wild sponsorship deal, offer us IP projects or whatever, you know, anything, you know where to find us.
We're down for fun.
We're down to clown. And we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.